Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. You know that saying, the more things change, the more they don't? Consumer privacy, we are looking at you. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, July the 22nd. Good as always to have you along, everybody. EFX is the marketplace ticker symbol of the day today. Equifax, the credit bureau, of course, that 2 years ago was hacked to the tune of private data for almost 150 million consumers. Shares were up today on EFX, 0.4% on news the company and federal regulators have come to terms on what could turn out to be a $700 million settlement. Yes, it's a very big number, a couple of hundred million in fines to state and federal agencies, a bit more than $400 million to consumers if, and this is a big if, they can prove they were harmed. But let us pause, if we might, and ask what, if anything, has really changed for the credit reporting industry and all of the data it controls. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams gets us going.
For Equifax, this settlement comes with new requirements to beef up its security to prevent more hacks. Chi-Chi Wu is with the National Consumer Law Center.
They say they have turned a leaf. We'll see if that actually happens. But remember, this just covers Equifax.
Wu points out this settlement doesn't make any demands on other credit bureaus like Experian or TransUnion.
They may not have been hacked to the scale that Equifax was, although they've had their own security problems.
Neither Equifax nor the main industry group for the credit bureaus would talk to us about what they've done to shore up their systems. But if you ask cybersecurity experts,
it's just as bad as it was before.
Gregory Tuhill teaches at Carnegie Mellon and runs the cybersecurity firm Sixtera Federal Group. He says if there have been any meaningful changes,
it's not evident to me as a consumer, nor have I seen anything substantive from the regulatory agencies.
Giving consumers more control over their personal data. Alan Spence with identity protection firm ID Shield says that's because policymakers are still trying to figure out how the murky consumer data industry works.
I think Congress is trying to learn more about it themselves. I didn't think they realized how big and how massive this breach could happen.
There is one change since the 2017 Equifax breach. Congress did pass a law to let consumers freeze their credit file for free. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Here's a little tidbit from the Federal Trade Commission's summary of this settlement. Gives you kind of a sense of scale. If you can show you were affected by this hack, you get up to 10 years of free credit monitoring or $125 if you decide not to enroll in credit monitoring because you already have it. Most Americans, by the way, do from prior breaches, right? Anyway, $125 times 147 million people potentially affected, $18.3 billion more than Equifax is worth on the open market today. Okay, over in the land of what's on TV tonight for 6.5 million households in this economy, it is not CBS, thanks to an argument between the network and AT&T, owner of the U-verse cable service and DirecTV. The contract between the two in question expired over the weekend, and the two sides are still haggling over how much CBS's programming and the audience that programming attracts is worth to AT&T. Carriage fees is the technical term you're looking for here. Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that one.
What we're seeing play out here is basically a game of chicken over how much AT&T owes CBS. The question is, who's going to blink first? CBS is the most watched TV network in the country, and it's trying to use that fact to squeeze more money out of AT&T.
This is a strong-arm tactic. It's a very competitive move.
Maurice Schweitzer is an expert on negotiation at the Wharton School, and he thinks CBS has the power here.
Before CBS pulled this move, I'm sure that they ran numbers to figure out that they had a lot of leverage.
There's a lot on the line for both companies. AT&T could lose subscribers. It also needs to control costs so it can pay down all the debt it's taken on lately to do things like buy Time Warner. CBS wants to get as much as it can out of AT&T without losing viewers or advertisers. But Brad Adgate, a media consultant in Cambridge, Massachusetts, says there's no real rush for either company to settle this until September.
I think then you'll start to see a little bit of concern on if this is going to get settled in time for the football season so I can watch, you know, the New England Patriots and other football games on the network.
Live sports are still a big moneymaker for TV networks. Adgate says we may never know which company blinked first. Once CBS and AT&T come to an agreement, the details will probably be private. I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
Wall Street on this Monday was generally up, but with varying degrees of enthusiasm. Let me just say, by the way, the traders think that whole AT&T-CBS spat is not very smart. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Spent a couple of days last week up in Aspen, Colorado, a Fortune magazine conference there. And as one does when traveling for business or, in my case, waiting around for an interview, one of them spending a lot of time checking my Slack, which was apropos.
I'm Kai. Good to see you. How are you?
Because the guy I was waiting for.
I was literally just checking my Slack from work, even though I'm taking the day off.
Can't get away.
Runs the company. Stuart Butterfield is the co-founder and CEO of Slack. It's a messaging app started back in 2013, since popularized in workplaces around the country and around the world. Slack's got 10 million users and went public in a direct listing on the New York Stock Exchange about a month ago. But that doesn't mean that everybody totally gets what this company does.
There will be people who listen to this interview who don't know what Slack is.
What?
I know.
Seems impossible.
Well, look, me 2 years ago would have been the same thing.
Yep.
Right? And many others. So what's the, you know, for those who don't know?
If I want to put it in really simple terms, I would say it's a messaging app for Teams. I don't think that really gives you the whole picture.
That tells me nothing.
Yeah, so let me elaborate a little bit. So I guess the big thing is in Slack, messages go into what we call channels.
Mm-hmm.
So people are really used to using email to mediate their communication mm-hmm. inside of big organizations, small organizations, any of them. And in every case, each person has their own view. So everyone's inbox is unique. Everyone's inbox is locked away from everyone else. And mm-hmm. everyone's inbox is kind of partial and fragmented. So when you put messages into channels instead of inboxes, it's kind of a team-first or an organization-first approach to communication in contrast to an individual-first approach.
So let me ask you this, though. As the guy running the company, you're probably in a 1,000 channels at Slack HQ.
Literally
right?
Thousands.
Yes. So, which gets to my point. Mm-hmm. Isn't Slack sometimes a little bit overloading? And don't you have to sort of decide what you're not going to participate in and mute and all this? I mean, how do you use it on a daily basis?
You do. And I think it takes some getting used to. I mean, people have to adjust patterns of communication. Because if you look at it this way, imagine a 10,000 person organization. And the person who gets the most email inside of that organization might get 1/100% of all the email that's mm-hmm. going through the whole company. In Slack, what's typical for organizations of 10,000 is 10-15% of the messages will be in what we call public channels. So they're not public to the whole right. world. They're public inside of the organization. Right. So that's 1,000 times more access to information than you would otherwise have. So you want it, but the trick is you want it like, I want everything that's on the internet via Google. I just want right. to be able to search for it. I don't want it right. all coming at me all the time. So I think tuning notifications and channel membership and getting things set up just right, and also, you know, to be honest, some a cultural shift are necessary to really get the most out of it.
Do you leave desktop warnings on? Do you let it play a sound when you get a new Slack? I mean,
no, I don't. I have all sounds and all notifications off on all of my devices. So
smart man, yeah. smart man. Part of your vibe, though, actually, just to the whole notifications off thing, is you have to be able to detach. Right? Mm-hmm. You and this company try to take a really holistic view of life, not just work life, but life.
Yeah.
How do you disconnect when your boss, or well, my boss, not your boss, can Slack you at 9 o'clock at night and say, hey, where's this story?
Well, I'm glad your boss isn't slacking me at 9 o'clock at night.
She's actually not on Slack, but that's a whole different thing.
So I think people have to shift their behaviors a little bit. And this is not a new problem. I remember, you know, Walt Mossberg, longtime columnist for the Wall Street Journal. He switched to Slack in 2016 or 2017.
It's kind of late.
Yeah. Well, when Vox bought
Oh, of course, yeah.
He wanted to do an interview, and he's, well, it's a famously cranky guy. And
we're going to leave that in, by the way.
Okay, so that's good. I'm sure he'll appreciate it. But he was saying, it's too many notifications. It's too busy. There's too much going on. And I reminded him, I don't remember he wrote this, but in the journal in 2001, there's this article about BlackBerries are ruining our lives. Man. There's no such thing as a vacation anymore. There's no work-life balance. So it is, once you get a technology, there's a period of adjusting to it to get the most out of it while kind of minimizing the downside.
Do you want to replace email? Is that the deal?
Want to replace email for internal communication, so inside of companies. Right. There are hundreds of millions of people whose working lives are mediated by email who should be using Slack or something like it. So maybe we don't end up with 100% market share, but the market is orders of magnitude bigger than where we're at today.
Are you still then a small, scrappy startup?
I don't think so anymore. We're a gangly adolescent, maybe, something like that.
Going up against Microsoft. I mean, that's got to be intimidating.
Well, I don't know if you've ever seen that picture of the Microsoft team when they're still in Albuquerque in 1977.
Oh, of course, yeah. With Bill Gates and Paul Allen. Sure.
Yeah, I mean, if listeners can Google that, it's...
Are you guys are that picture? Is that the comparison you're making?
No, but if you look at that picture...
Because that's a gutsy move, man.
I can't remember if it's 77 or 79, but by 1982, the tides had turned, and IBM, which was the biggest and most powerful, most valuable company in the entire world, just got bested by Microsoft. So the point I'm trying to make here is sometimes the small startup with real traction with customers has an advantage versus the large incumbent with multiple lines of business and a lot of stuff to protect.
So I'm going to pull up the Marketplace's Slack app here. And let's see, our channels, there's Hot on Social. There's a thing for a podcast I do. There's newsletter recommendations. There's party people. There may well be one that's like Dogs of Marketplace that I'm not on, you know? So there is a certain amount of... less serious communication than happens on Slack, right?
There is.
You're good with that.
I'm really good with that. So you think about, there's some frivolous ones for sure. There's a channel inside of our Slack instance for fans of Rick and Morty and another one for fans of Game of Thrones. But there's also one called Parentland, which is a private channel and people use it to give each other help and advice and support for people who have young kids. There's a phenomenon whereby trust and the amount of communication required to get a job done are inversely correlated. So in a high trust environment, you don't really need to communicate very much. In a low trust environment, at every point is kind of lawyered and you go back and forth and people are questioning each other constantly. That makes a huge difference to how easy it is to get work done.
Stuart Butterfield, thanks a lot.
Thank you for having me.
On the theory that there is no such thing as too much of a multi-billion dollar movie franchise, the Marvel Universe Phase 4 is about to be upon us. At San Diego Comic-Con over the weekend, Marvel, owned, of course, by Disney, rolled out its movie and TV plans for the next couple of years. 10 movies in all, including the first ever Asian superhero in a lead role, the first deaf superhero, and the first openly gay superhero in a Marvel movie. Because a more inclusive Marvel Universe is good for Disney's bottom line, as Marketplace's Megan McCarty-Carino reports.
24-year-old Marvel fan Dallas Schwab has seen plenty of homophobic references on screen, like in the 2002 Spider-Man, where the hero, then played by Tobey Maguire, comments on a male rival's unitard.
That's a cute outfit. Did your husband give it to you?
I watched that in theaters when I was a kid as kind of an insult.
So when he heard that the upcoming Thor installment will feature a lesbian storyline, he was encouraged.
To have a movie franchise like Marvel be so big and to really lean into the representation, I think is going to be extraordinarily meaningful to people.
And potentially lucrative for the studio. Darnell Hunt, a professor of sociology at UCLA who tracks diversity in Hollywood, says films with broader representation perform better at the box office.
Let's face it, everything we've seen in our studies suggests that audiences want to see this, and they will go and they will support these films.
He says the trend set by the massive success of Black Panther and Crazy Rich Asians will only intensify.
The present, and certainly the future, as America becomes more diverse, will be dependent upon having films that are populated with characters that look like America.
But it's not enough to simply cast more diverse characters on screen, says Nancy Wong Yoon, author of Real Inequality.
Audiences are really savvy now. They want to see authentic storytelling. They want to see parts of the story that really embrace and reflect their lived experiences.
And that means increasing diversity behind the scenes as well. Marvel is bringing on a female and Asian director for their upcoming films, but Dallas Schwab says he's not yet sure he'll run to see the new Thor movie just because of a diverse character.
Unless they make it kind of a sticking point in the movie and not just an afterthought.
But done right, the move could recruit a whole new legion of fans to the Marvel Universe. I'm Megan McCarty-Carino for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's just a minimal living that allows you like the freedom to make choices of what you do with your time and what you do with your money.
Choosing to live on the road. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials gained less than a 0.1% today, up 17 points, 27,172. The S&P 500 gained 0.2%, 8 points, 29.85. The NASDAQ up 0.7%, 57 points, 82.04. Halliburton was one of today's biggest gainers after the oilfield services company reported quarterly earnings this morning that beat estimates. Shares closed up 9.1% today. Earnings season, though, not so kind to Houston-based Cadence Bancorp. Missed analyst predictions and closed down 19.1%. Told you about CBS and AT&T? Nope. CBS ended the session down 1.3%. AT&T closed 2% lower on the day. Bonds held steady. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note, 2.04%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. I read a story in the New York Times the other day that gave me a start about how safe deposit boxes maybe aren't really all that safe after all. Didn't quite run on down to my local bank branch and empty my box, but totally thought about it. Stacey Cowley had the byline on the article. Stacey, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
I have to tell you, as I said in the introduction, I read this piece yesterday and immediately wanted to run down to my local bank branch and clean out my safe deposit box. Should we?
I have heard that from a few people who've read the story. The email box is kind of full of similar sentiments.
Well, I mean, I don't have, you know, $10 million worth of watches like the guy you start your piece with, but lots of people have lots of things in safe deposit boxes. How protected are we?
Well, in terms of the liability the bank is willing to accept if something goes wrong, not very. If you fish out the terms and conditions of your safe deposit box, it probably includes a limitation of liability that is probably going to be a smaller number than you would expect. In the case of Wells Fargo, it's as little as $500. In the case of some other major banks, it's a few thousand. But if people are storing tens of thousands of dollars worth of things in their boxes, or hundreds of thousands or millions, that's not going to be enough to cover the loss if there is one.
To the anecdote that you, or not anecdote, to the story that you begin this piece with, Mr. Ponitz and his watch collection. The bank has not admitted, obviously, to any wrongdoing, but how did they get his stuff? Because Mr. Ponitz had a key, the bank had a key. Did they just go in and I don't know how they get the stuff out?
When a bank has to open a box without the customer's consent, what they typically do is bring in a locksmith and drill it. What appears to have happened in his case, which was kind of unusual, was the bank accidentally had two boxes in its vault with the same number, his and another customer's. They went to evict the other box, mixed them up, and drilled into his and emptied it out.
Important point here, which you say in your piece, the reason they had two with the same number is they were closing another bank branch, and they consolidated, and that's how it happened. And of course, bank branch closures are rampant now.
Yeah, pretty large number of bank branches have closed down over the last decade. The footprint is shrinking. So the more that happens, the more this kind of situation is arising.
And you say the banks often have the upper hand in court, should it go that way.
Yeah, the banks really have a lot of fine print on their side in this. There's a lot of contract law on their side. There's also statutes of limitations that come into play. I found a very large number of court cases where the consumers did not come out on the good side of it.
We have, I think, five or six federal bank regulators in this economy. Are none of them responsible for safe deposit boxes?
The Office of the Comptroller of the Currency is the primary federal regulator for these things, and they explicitly say, we don't really regulate safe deposit boxes. This is something that, for various historical reasons, partially accidental, has largely fallen to state regulators. And states have various regulations in place, but the ability to enforce them is, of course, up to the states. There is no national federal player really focused on this.
Not to go with a trope here, but what are people doing with their stuff? Are they sticking it under their mattresses?
Some of that. Certainly, I've heard from any number of readers who are turning to Bank of Mattress. Home vaults are increasingly popular. People tend to just keep things around their house. But yeah, just this whole idea of keeping your valuables, you know, back in the day, I've heard from a lot of people who say, you know, grandma and grandpa used to keep birth certificates and passports and things like that in their safe deposit box. People now more typically keep those at home.
Stacey Cowley covers business and finance for the New York Times. Stacey, thanks a lot.
Thanks again.
Home prices and rent being what they are in this economy, which is to say high, a lot of people are looking for alternatives to the idea of home ownership or long-term rentals. And for some of those people, the alternative falls under the heading van life, the idea that experiences are more valuable than things. Sammy Keola at Capital Public Radio in Sacramento looked into why people are going from four walls to four wheels.
So I hop in with this guy who uses the professional name Travis Wild. We're in his shiny navy blue Dodge van.
Yeah, so this is a bumpier hood. This looks like a cool spot that I can back into, potentially.
He's 31 and has been living in this van for about 3 years. He's constantly looking for a new campsite to call his temporary home. Tonight, he rolls up on a rocky riverbank and lets his dog Ayla out.
She's got a lot of energy to get out. It was probably a little less than 7 hours of driving to get here.
The inside of Wild's van is comfortable and clean.
It's pretty simple.
The walls are pine, the floor is bamboo, the bed is surrounded by bookshelves, and a surfboard hangs from the ceiling. Wild bought the 2006 Dodge Sprinter van for $14,000, then spent $10,000 on the build-out, plus $2,000 to tune up the mechanics. He shows me some space-saving tricks, like this hidden table that slides out.
From right here. Just from under the bed.
Whoa.
And then continuing, just all of this is storage on the sides.
Wild is a wedding photographer. Between shoots and some extra cash from blogging, he makes about $36,000 a year. Before this, he lived on a rented boat near San Diego and worked in the travel industry. He has health insurance, and so does his dog, Ayla. He doesn't have a retirement plan, but says he's paying off credit card debt and making plans to invest. Finances can be stressful, but Wild says the freedom is worth it.
I'm writing, I'm getting to see a lot more. I get to meet a lot of people. And if something happens next week in Colorado I want to go see, I go see that.
It's hard to quantify how many people are choosing this lifestyle as opposed to living in cars out of necessity. But the four or five big van life gatherings a year draw hundreds of people. And there are those who spend thousands of dollars on their vans. One popular brand mentioned in Van Life social media pages is the Mercedes Sprinter. The cargo version starts at about $34,000 and can be tricked out with more add-ons. Though some people, like Josh Thompson, just retrofit their own. He's sawing wood for a sleeping platform in his Dodge Ram 2500.
So the bed will be up here, and this will be like kind of storage area for extra bike space, and then also just like climbing gear and whatnot.
Thompson, age 34, served in the Coast Guard and was an outdoor instructor for a while, but now he just wants to hit the road.
Like, life's pretty short, you know? It's just a minimal living that allows you like the freedom to make choices of what you do with your time and what you do with your money.
Van life fits the millennial profile, says Gabrielle Lewine, a grad student in psychology at the University of Southern California. She's researched millennials and their hopes and goals. She says they're redefining the American dream.
In the same way that kind of millennials are, you know, to use the very trendy word of disrupting other kind of marketplaces, non-traditional living situations is, I think, just another piece of that trend.
And the downsides? Finding a place where it's legal to park overnight for free. Wild says vehicle maintenance and finding internet connectivity can also be a struggle.
So there's always like these little kinks that are, at first it's like, oh, this is part of the adventure. And then you're like, oh, this is like, it's rainy and I have to stay inside here a little bit more than I would have liked to.
None of that is a deterrent for him, yet. But he says he might consider leaving the van life if he found a partner who wanted to settle down. In Sacramento, I'm Sammy Keola for Marketplace.
Sammy's story came to us from the California Dream Project. That's a nonprofit news collaborative out here. This final note on the way out today, our one and only pass at Robert Mueller's congressional testimony later this week. Regular listeners to this program will know of my exasperation at the proliferation of pumpkin spice flavorings in this economy and the company responsible for it. So it was with no small shock that I read the following sentence in a New York Times profile of the former special counsel this weekend. Quote, Mr. Mueller, an early riser, was known among close FBI aides to be fond of Starbucks pumpkin spice lattes. And we are out of here. The Dow up less than a 0.1% today, 17 points. NASDAQ up 57 points, 0.7% there. S&P 500, 0.2% higher, 8 points. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shen. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.